Hello and welcome to National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. Let's finish the article that we started last week called Who Were the First Europeans? The way this article is organized is in waves. So we're going to talk about the first wave out of Africa. Not a bad movie either. 32 years ago, the study of the DNA of living humans helped establish that we all share a family tree and a primordial migration story. All people outside Africa are descended from ancestors who left that continent more than 60,000 years ago. About 45,000 years ago, those first modern humans ventured into Europe, having made their way up through the Middle East. Their own DNA suggests that they had dark skin and perhaps light eyes. Europe then was a forbidding place. Mile-thick ice sheets covered parts of the continent. Where there was enough warmth, there was wildlife. There were also other humans, but not like us, Neanderthals, whose own ancestors had wandered out of Africa hundreds of thousands of years earlier, had already adapted to the cold and harsh conditions. The first modern Europeans lived as hunters and gatherers in small nomadic bands. They followed the rivers, edging along the Danube from its mouth on the Black Sea, deep into Western and Central Europe. For millennia, they made little impact. Their DNA indicates they mixed with the Neanderthals, who, within 5,000 years, were gone. Today, about 2% of a typical European's genome consists of Neanderthal DNA. A typical African has none. As Europe was gripped by the Ice Age, the modern humans hung on in the ice-free south, adapting to the cold climate. Around 27,000 years ago, there may have been as few as 1,000 of them, according to some population estimates. They subsisted on large mammals such as mammoths, horses, reindeer, and aurochs, the ancestors of modern cattle. In the caves where they sheltered, they left behind spectacular paintings and engravings of their prey. About 14,500 years ago, as Europe began to warm, humans followed the retreating glaciers north. In the ensuing millennia, they developed more sophisticated stone tools and settled in small villages. Archaeologists call this period the Mesolithic or Middle Stone Age. In the 1960s, Serbian archaeologists uncovered a Mesolithic fishing village nestled in steep cliffs on a bend of the Danube near one of the river's narrowest points. Called Lipenski Vir, the site was an elaborate settlement that had housed as many as 100 people, starting roughly 9,000 years ago. Some dwellings were furnished with carved sculptures that were half human, half fish. Bones found at Lipenski Vir indicated that the people there depended heavily on fish from the river. Today, what remains of the village is preserved under a canopy overlooking the Danube. Sculptures of goggle-eyed river gods still watch over ancient hearths. 70% of their diet was fish, says Vladimir Notkovic, the site's director. They lived here almost 2,000 years until farmers pushed them out. The second wave is out of Anatolia. The Konya Plain in central Anatolia is modern Turkey's breadbasket, a fertile expanse where you can see rainstorms blotting out mountains on the horizon long before they begin spattering the dust around you. It has been home to farmers, says University of Liverpool archaeologist Douglas Baird, since the first days of farming. For more than a decade, Baird has been excavating a prehistoric village here called Bonkuklu. It's a place where people began planting small plots of emmer and einkorn, two ancient forms of wheat, and probably herding small flocks of sheep and goats some 10,300 years ago, near the dawn of the Neolithic period. Within 1,000 years, the Neolithic Revolution, as it's called, spread north through Anatolia and into southeastern Europe. By about 6,000 years ago, there were farmers and herders all across Europe. It has long been clear that Europe acquired the practice of farming from Turkey or the Levant. But did it acquire farmers from the same places? The answer isn't obvious. For decades, many archaeologists thought a whole suite of innovations, farming, but also ceramic pottery, polished stone axes capable of clearing forests, and complicated settlements, was carried into Europe not by migrants, but by trade and word of mouth, from one valley to the next, as hunter-gatherers who already lived there adopted the new tools and way of life. But DNA evidence from Mon Kuklu has helped show that migration had a lot more to do with it. The farmers of Mon Kuklu kept their dead close, burying them in the fetal position under the floors of their houses. Beginning in 2014, Baird sent samples of DNA extracted from skull fragments and teeth from more than a dozen burials to DNA labs in Sweden, Turkey, the UK, and Germany. Many of the samples were too badly degraded after spending millennia in the heat of the Konya Plain to yield much DNA. But then Johannes Krauss and his team at Germany's Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History tested the samples from a handful of Petrus bones. The Petrus bone is a tiny part of the inner ear, not much bigger than a pinky tip. It's also about the densest bone in the body. Researchers have found that it preserves genetic information long after usable DNA has been baked out of the rest of a skeleton. That realization, along with better sequencing machines, has helped drive the explosion in ancient DNA studies. The Mon Kuklu Petrus bones paid off. DNA extracted from them was a match for farmers who lived and died centuries later and hundreds of miles to the northwest. That meant early Anatolian farmers had migrated, spreading their genes as well as their lifestyle. They didn't stop in southeastern Europe. Over the centuries, their descendants pushed along the Danube past Lipensky Vir and deep into the heart of the continent. Others traveled along the Mediterranean by boat, colonizing islands such as Sardinia and Sicily, and settling southern Europe as far as Portugal. From Mon Kuklu to Britain, the Anatolian genetic signature is found wherever farming first appears. Those Neolithic farmers mostly had light skin and dark eyes, the opposite of many of the hunter-gatherers with whom they now lived side by side. They looked different, spoke different languages, had different diets, says Hartwick College archaeologist David Anthony. For the most part, they stayed separate. Across Europe, this creeping first contact was standoffish, sometimes for centuries. There's little evidence of one group taking up the tools or traditions of the other. Even where the two populations did mingle, intermarriage was rare. There's no question that they were in contact with each other, but they weren't exchanging wives or husbands, Anthony says. Defying every anthropology course, people were not having sex with each other. Fear of the other has a long history. About 5,400 years ago, everything changed. All across Europe, thriving Neolithic settlements shrank or disappeared altogether. The dramatic decline has puzzled archaeologists for decades. There's less stuff, less material, less people, less sites, Krauss says. Without some major event, it's hard to explain, but there's no sign of mass conflict or war. After a 500-year gap, the population seemed to grow again, but something was very different. In southeastern Europe, the villages and egalitarian cemeteries of the Neolithic were replaced by imposing grave mounds covering lone adult men. Farther north, from Russia to the Rhine, a new culture sprang up called corded ware after its pottery, which was decorated by pressing string into wet clay. The State Museum of Prehistory in Halle, Germany, has dozens of corded ware graves, including many that were hastily rescued by archaeologists before construction crews went to work. To save time and preserve delicate remains, the graves were removed from the ground in wooden crates, soil and all, and stored in a warehouse for later analysis. Stacked to the ceiling on steel shelves, they're now a rich resource for geneticists. Corded ware burials are so recognizable. Archaeologists rarely need to bother with radiocarbon dating. Corded ware burials are so recognizable. Archaeologists rarely need to bother with radiocarbon dating. Almost invariably, men were buried lying on their right side and women lying on their left, both with their legs curled up and their faces pointed south. In some of the hollow warehouse's graves, women clutch purses and bags hung with canine teeth from dozens of dogs. Men have stone battle axes. In one grave, neatly contained in a wooden crate on the concrete floor of the warehouse, a woman and child are buried together. When researchers first analyzed the DNA from some of these graves, they expected the corded werefolk would be closely related to Neolithic farmers. Instead, their DNA contained distinctive genes that were new to Europe at the time, but are detectable now in just about every modern European population. Many corded ware people turned out to be more closely related to Native Americans than to Neolithic European farmers. That deepened the mystery of who they were. And that brings us to the third wave, out of the steppe. One bright October morning, near the Serbian town of Zabal, Polish archaeologist Piotr Vlodarczak and his colleagues steer their pickup toward a mound erected 4,700 years ago. On the plains flanking the Danube, mounds like this one, 100 feet across and 10 feet high, provide the only topography. It would have taken weeks or months for prehistoric humans to build each one. It took Vlodarczak's team weeks of digging with a backhoe and shovels to remove the top of the mound. Standing on it now, he peels back a tarp to reveal what's underneath, a rectangular chamber containing the skeleton of a chieftain, lying on his back with his knees bent. Impressions from the reed mats and wood beams that formed the roof of his tomb are still clear in the dark, hard-packed earth. It's a change of burial customs around 2800 BC, Vlodarczak says, crouching over the skeleton. People erected mounds on a massive scale, accenting the individuality of people, accenting the role of men, accenting weapons. That's something new in Europe. It was not new 800 miles to the east, however, on what are now the steppes of southern Russia and eastern Ukraine. A group of nomads called the Yamnaya, some of the first people in the world to ride horses, had mastered the wheel and were building wagons and following herds of cattle across the grasslands. They built few permanent settlements, but they buried their most prominent men with bronze and silver ornaments in mighty grave mounds that still dot the steppes. By 2800 BC, archaeological excavations show, the Yamnaya had begun moving west, probably looking for greener pastures. Vlodarczak's mound near Zabal, I've got to spell that for you. It's Z with a little circumflex. Is that a circumflex above it? It's a little smile above the Z. A-B-A-L-J. I have no understanding of Polish pronunciation. So Vlodarczak's mound near Zabal is the westernmost Yamnaya grave found so far. But genetic evidence, Reich and others say, shows that many corded ware people were, to a large extent, their descendants. Like those corded ware skeletons, the Yamnaya shared distant kinship with Native Americans, whose ancestors hailed from farther east in Siberia. Within a few centuries, other people with a significant amount of Yamnaya DNA had spread as far as the British Isles. In Britain and some other places, hardly any of the farmers who already lived in Europe survived the onslaught from the east. In what is now Germany, there's a 70% to possibly 100% replacement of the local population, Reich says. Something very dramatic happens 4,500 years ago. Until then, farmers had been thriving in Europe for millennia. They had settled from Bulgaria all the way to Ireland, often in complex villages that housed hundreds or even thousands of people. Volker Hyde, an archaeologist at the University of Helsinki, Finland, estimates that there were as many as 7 million people in Europe in 3000 BC. In Britain, Neolithic people were constructing Stonehenge. To many archaeologists, the idea that a bunch of nomads could replace such an established civilization within a few centuries has seemed implausible. How the hell would these pastoral, decentralized groups overthrow grounded Neolithic society, even if they had horses and were good warriors, asks Christian Christiansen, an archaeologist at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. A clue comes from the teeth of 101 people living on the steppes and farther west in Europe around the time that the Yamnaya's westward migration began. In 7 of the samples, alongside the human DNA, geneticists found the DNA of an early form of Yersinia pestis, the plague microbe that killed roughly half of all Europeans in the 14th century. Unlike that flea-borne Black Death, this early variant had to be passed from person to person. The steppe nomads apparently had lived with the disease for centuries, perhaps building up immunity or resistance, much as the Europeans who colonized the Americas carried smallpox without succumbing to it wholesale. And just as smallpox and other diseases ravaged Native American populations, the plague, once introduced by the first Yamnaya, might have spread rapidly through crowded Neolithic villages. That could explain both their surprising collapse and the rapid spread of Yamnaya DNA from Russia to Britain. Plague epidemics cleared the way for the Yamnaya expansion, says Morten Allentoft, an evolutionary biologist at the Natural History Museum of Denmark, who helped identify the ancient plague DNA. But that theory has a major question. Evidence of plague has only just recently been documented in ancient Neolithic skeletons, and so far no one has found anything like the plague pits full of diseased skeletons left behind after the Black Death. If a plague wiped out Europe's Neolithic farmers, it left little trace. Whether or not they brought plague, the Yamnaya did bring domesticated horses and a mobile lifestyle based on wagons into Stone Age Europe. And in bringing innovative metal weapons and tools, they may have helped nudge Europe toward the Bronze Age. That might not have been the Yamnaya's most significant contribution to Europe's development. Their arrival on the continent matches the time linguists pinpoint as the initial spread of Indo-European languages, a family of hundreds that includes most languages spoken from Ireland to Russia to the northern half of India. All are thought to have evolved from a single Proto-Indo-European tongue, and the question of where it was spoken and by whom has been debated since the 19th century. According to one theory, it was the Neolithic farmers from Anatolia who brought it into Europe along with farming. Another theory, proposed a century ago by a German scholar named Gustav Cosina, held that the Proto-Indo-Europeans were an ancient race of North Germans, the people who made corded ware pots and axes. Cosina thought that the ethnicity of people in the past, their biological identity, in effect, could be deduced from the stuff they left behind. Sharply defined archaeological cultural areas, he wrote, correspond unquestionably with the areas of particular people or tribes. The North German tribe of Proto-Indo-Europeans, Cosina argued, had moved outward and dominated an area that stretched most of the way to Moscow. Nazi propagandists later used that as an intellectual justification for the modern Aryan master race to invade Eastern Europe. Partly as a result, for decades after World War II, the whole idea that ancient cultural shifts might be explained by migrations fell into ill repute in some archaeological circles. Even today, it makes some archaeologists uncomfortable when geneticists draw bold arrows across maps of Europe. This kind of simplicity leads back to Cosina, says Haidt, who's German. It calls back old demons of blonde, blue-eyed guys coming back somehow out of the hell where they were sent after World War II. Yet ancient DNA, which provides direct information about the biology of ancient humans, has become a strong argument against Cosina's theory. First, in documenting the spread of the Yamnaya and their descendants deeper and deeper into Europe at just the right time, the DNA evidence supports the favored theory among linguists that Proto-Indo-Europeans migrated into Europe from the Russian steppe, not the other way round. Second, together with archaeology, it amounts to a rejection of Cosina's claim that some kind of pure race exists in Europe, one that can be identified from its cultural artifacts. All Europeans today are a mix. The genetic recipe for a typical European would be roughly equal parts Yamnaya and Anatolian farmer, with a much smaller dollop of African hunter-gatherer. But the average conceals large regional variations, more Eastern cowboy genes in Scandinavia, more farmer ones in Spain and Italy, and significant chunks of hunter-gatherer DNA in the Baltics and Eastern Europe. To me, the new results from DNA are undermining the nationalist paradigm that we have always lived here and not mixed with other people, Gothenburg's Christensen says. There's no such thing as a Dane or a Swede or a German. Instead, we're all Russians, all Africans. There's a note that Andrew Curry, who wrote this article, writes about archaeology and other subjects from his base in Berlin, whereas Remy Benali, the photographer, lives near Arles, France, where he photographed a Roman boat for the April 2014 issue of National Geographic. Well, with the time that we have left, let's go ahead and begin an article called The Survivors. I'm not sure we'll make it all the way through, but you never know, we might. And I have to tell you about this beautiful photograph that starts the article. We see a wolverine in Montana's Swan Valley with all of its senses on alert. It triggers a camera trap while feeding on a deer carcass. These secretive predators are built for survival in frozen northern landscapes. Can they adapt to a warming world? What's so beautiful about this photograph is the wolverine itself. Its coat is absolutely glistening and shining, and it's got lots of shades of tan and auburn and blonde and charcoal. Very beautiful animal. One night years ago, biologist Albert Manville drove to a garbage dump near Lake Louise in Alberta's Banff National Park. The site was unfenced back then, and grizzlies often came to rummage for leftovers. Manville was watching a bear feast on a hefty scrap of meat when he noticed movement toward the edge of his car's beaming headlights. It was a wolverine staring intently at the bear and the meat. What else could it do? It weighed maybe 30 pounds. The grizzly weighed several hundred. Then all at once, the wolverine ran up and bit the bear right on the butt, Manville says. The grizzly whirled and swiped with a paw, but the wolverine was already racing around to one side. It grabbed the meat and ran off into the dark. A wolverine doesn't seem like a reasonable beast, for it acts too tough and brazen for its size. But at barely 3 feet long from keen nose to bushy tail, an average wolverine will claim a territory of 100 to more than 500 square miles, then patrol it at an unrelenting pace, sniffing, probing, hunting, scavenging, and defending its home from rivals. In the 5 years that I volunteered with a groundbreaking study in Montana's Glacier National Park, I tracked one radio-tagged male as he climbed 1,500 feet straight up an ice-packed chute on a sheer mountainside and crossed the Continental Divide. The ascent took him less than 20 minutes. Another male scaled the park's highest summit, 10,466-foot-high Mount Cleveland, in January, when the peak was a towering ice sculpture. He covered the last 4,900 feet in 90 minutes. Within the next 10 days, he climbed other crests to the west, turned north into British Columbia, loped east across the Divide and on through Waterton Lakes National Park in Alberta, and returned south across more massifs to get back to the glacier. No big deal. Within a day or two, he took off and made the journey all over again. Skunk bear, mountain devil, demon of the north. For centuries, wolverines were defined not only as greedy, god-awful smelling and eerily wily and elusive, but also as foul-tempered, wantonly destructive, and a danger to people in the backcountry. But none of these characterizations fit. Gulo gulo, from the Latin word for glutton, is native to Arctic, subarctic, and mountain regions of the northern hemisphere. The species is part of the large and varied mustelid family, many of which have revved up metabolisms. The group includes martens, weasels, badgers, honey badgers, otters, and sea otters. Of the group's non-aquatic members, the wolverine has the heaviest skull, thickest jaws, biggest teeth, largest body, and largest feet. A single gulo can bring down prey as large as an adult caribou, and unverified reports describe wolverines occasionally forcing wolves and even big bears away from a carcass. The last thing a wolverine is, so it would seem, is vulnerable. But trappers, hunters, and livestock owners erase the animal from much of Eurasia. In the New World, government-sponsored predator eradication campaigns took a heavy toll. By the 1930s, the species had disappeared from the lower 48 states. Yet wolverines are tenacious survivors that still have strongholds in Alaska and parts of western Canada. As predator poisoning was phased out during the 1960s, wolverines from the Canadian Rockies started to recolonize Montana's high country and spread to parts of Idaho and northern Wyoming. Then, in the 1990s, wolverines from Canada began venturing into Washington's northern Cascades. Today, breeding groups live in four states, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington. But the population remains small. A recent estimate put the number of wolverines south of Canada at around 300 animals. Meanwhile, populations on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border face a variety of threats. Most come from expanding human activities in the backcountry, but one concern overrides all others, a warming climate. Gulo Gulo is specially adapted to, and highly dependent on, habitats with year-round cool conditions and lingering snowpack. Although polar regions are heating up faster than other latitudes, similar temperature increases are happening in the planet's high altitudes, such as the Rockies. If climate change continues as predicted, wolverines could lose one-third of their present range south of Canada by 2050, and two-thirds before the end of this century. Since 1994, despite petitions and lawsuits seeking to protect wolverines under the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has resisted listing wolverines as threatened. In 2016, citing the growing threat of climate change, a federal judge ordered the agency to reconsider its decision. That's where the matter stands today, in limbo. Glacier National Park is home to the densest populations of wolverines in the contiguous U.S. But because each wolverine jealously guards a huge territory, a total of 30 to 40 is about all that will ever fit into the 1,500-square-mile park. Fact is, no single preserve holds a wolverine population large enough to be truly self-sustaining. To cope with environmental changes and avoid inbreeding over the long run, every group needs to be connected to others within a larger region. Biologists used to say that the best plan to conserve wildlife is to set aside parks and preserves. Now they say we must also safeguard natural corridors that link protected areas, ensuring that species such as wolverines can travel across large landscapes, exchange genes, and adjust to shifting conditions. Wolverines aren't much for theory, but they know instinctively not to do things halfway. You have to go the distance. And wildlife biologist and writer Douglas H. Chadwick, who wrote this article, is author of The Wolverine Way. With that, I need to leave you for the week, and I hope that you'll be back next week for more of National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford, and I thank you for listening.